This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Matthew Dellavedova has his own signature basketball shoe. And if you don't know who he is, you're not alone. He's a veteran guard for the Milwaukee Bucks. He's never made an all-star team. His career scoring average is 6 points per game. He isn't even in the Bucks starting lineup, but he has his own shoe, the Peak Deli Ones. Matthew Dellavedova notwithstanding, a signature shoe deal says to a player, you've made it. About 20 active NBA players wear shoes designed especially for them and sold to the public. In the WNBA, the number of players with signature shoes is zero. But it wasn't always like this. Only a Game's Matthew Stock has the story.
Dawn Staley is the head women's basketball coach at the University of South Carolina. She won 3 Olympic gold medals and is one of the greatest WNBA players of all time. And when she was a kid, basketball shoes were everything.
You know, I grew up in the projects in North Philly. I grew up wearing a lot of different sneakers. I didn't care what I looked like from my ankles up. I had to have the newest, the best pair of sneakers out there.
Dawn remembers wearing Charles Barkley's signature line. She wasn't much of a Jordan fan. In any case, she wore men's shoes.
Everybody that I played with were males. That's what I wore. That's what I was comfortable wearing. And I just really didn't know a difference.
Basketball shoes for women didn't exist when Dawn was growing up. But before long, that changed. In the summer of 1996, Dawn and Team USA won their first gold medal at the Olympic Games in Atlanta.
Women's basketball was pretty much at an all-time high.
The American Basketball League, or ABL, had been founded a year earlier. The WNBA followed shortly after. And as the country saw women's basketball gaining popularity, Nike saw a groundbreaking business opportunity.
To me, now later in life, I feel that it was more special and amazing than it felt at the time.
Marnie Gerber has been a senior designer at Nike since 1992. In the lead-up to the 96 Olympics, she and Nike partnered with Team USA star Cheryl Swoops to design a signature basketball shoe. By then, Nike had released 10 Michael Jordan signature shoes in the Air Jordan line. Several other NBA players had their own models, too. But in the women's game, Cheryl Swoops' shoe would be the first. And for Gerber, that meant rethinking what basketball shoes could be.
At the time, basketball shoes were really overbuilt. Cheryl's not giant like some of these guys are, so how could I design a shoe that was less shoe and more her?
Gerber watched Cheryl play at the Team USA training camp, taking notes on how she moved on the court. She even joined Cheryl on a trip to her hometown of Lubbock, Texas, to get to know her outside of basketball.
I went to her hairdresser with her. I met her mom. We went to the Outback Steakhouse, and that was kind of like the cool spot to go to in Lubbock back then.
Gerber says she had never worked so closely with an athlete.
We actually got to know each other pretty well before I even started designing, and I think that was helpful. Then she felt comfortable talking to me. She's larger than life. She's an amazing athlete. Everybody knows her, but she's also just this down-home, real sweet person.
In 1995, Nike released the first ever women's signature basketball shoe, the Air Swoops. It featured a lower ankle cut so Cheryl could move quicker on the court and a Velcro strap across the top of the shoe for extra stability.
There's an S shape on the bottom of that shoe. And basically, when she's up in the air, that was to put Cheryl Swoops SS in your face. The kind of swirliness of that logo with Cheryl's name was to kind of show the feminine side of her. And then also, the shoe was pretty bold and dynamic, and that was the athlete side of her. When I drew that SS on the bottom of the shoe, it felt like, okay, this is the right way to go.
In the early 90s, Jane McManus was a young professional playing pickup basketball in New York City.
I was literally taking the ball in my own hands and, you know, walking into courts where there were just guys playing and saying I wanted next.
Jane remembers going into shoe stores and being told that there weren't shoes made specifically for women.
What did you make of that when people were like, there's not even an option?
Well, I thought it was kind of garbage. But I heard about the Air Swoops coming out, and I really wasn't enough of a high roller to know if I could go for one of those brand name sneakers. But these shoes, I just really felt it was important, if I'm a woman playing basketball, to buy a pair of shoes that's been specifically designed for a woman and marketed to her. They were like a navy, shiny, they looked like molten metal. They're not even an actual color. And I opened up the box and they just looked so cool. I just thought, wow, I hope my game can pull these shoes off. You're going to wear those shoes onto a court, you better be able to back it up.
4 seconds, look
Nike released a second Air Swoops model just before the 96 Olympics, and the Air Swoops Zoom a year after that. In 98, the brand teamed up with star WNBA center Lisa Leslie on the Air Total 9s.
It's Lisa Leslie with the dunk.
And in 1999, Dawn Staley debuted the Nike Air Zoom S5, her own signature shoe.
Staley, jump shot from the elbow. Good!
What was it like then to see that finished product for the first time?
I was really happy to see the prototype. When they sent me the prototype, I wanted to go really ball. I wanted to show everybody in the neighborhood. I wanted them to look at it, to approve of it, to want a pair. And then when I got the real deal, I mean, it was like 100 Christmases tied up in one. Unbelievable. It was white based, and then there were some accents on the toe, some accents on the heel. The strap was a different color with my S5 logo. And it was just a really clean looking shoe. If you wore a white uniform, they pop. If you wore a red uniform, they pop. People were immediately drawn to my feet.
And did you like it that way?
I did. You know, I was a 1996 sneakerhead.
A personal designer from Nike didn't visit Dawn in her hometown, but she still feels that her shoe represented her and the expectations she had for herself.
My shoe was built on Philly. It was built on toughness. It was built on being able to handle whatever was thrown at me. It was built on being an odds beater. When I had my signature shoe on, I was in my mode of, this is it. This is like, you know, basketball utopia for me.
As Dawn Staley and Cheryl Swoops rocked their signature shoes on the WNBA stage, a new generation of players was watching, including future four-time WNBA champion Simone Augustus.
I remember my first game that I went to. My parents saved up money to drive us down to Houston from Baton Rouge. And we were, you know, at the Toyota Center, and we were literally at the top of the rafters. Like, we had our head against the poles at the top of the arena, and I had to watch the game from the Jumbotron, but I did not care because I was in the building. I was hoping and dreaming to one day be in their shoes. You know, it just made me want to go home right then and just get to work.
Just like their idols, Simone and her friends were sneakerheads.
Back in those days, like, they would come in and they have their sneaker towel where they're like clean off the scuff marks if there was some, or a toothbrush that really like make sure the rubber sole was clean.
Simone was in middle school when Cheryl Swoops and Team USA took home gold at the 1996 Olympics.
But by the time her shoe came out, I was like too big to shop in the ladies' Foot Locker and I couldn't get them. I assumed that they would make shoes for the basketball player. Like, you know, we're obviously taller, bigger than the average woman. I was super bummed out because it was like the first woman's shoe to come out and I wasn't able to get it. And I'm a hooper and I love Cheryl Swoops.
To make matters worse, two of Simone's middle school teammates had the new shoes.
I was just kind of envious of everyone else that had them. Every day coming to practice, it was annoying to see them. I'm like, ah, oh, I hope the rubber falls off or shoestrings break.
Simone went on to lead the LSU women's basketball team to three straight Final Four appearances. In 2006, she was the number one overall pick in the WNBA draft.
After Swoops got her shoe, I just assumed that so many other great women that came through the league would get their shoes and that I would be able to obviously get a pair, but it didn't happen.
Simone began her professional career at a tumultuous time for the WNBA. In the years before her debut, three teams folded and another two relocated. She says the league felt the effects of the recession in the late 2000s. And by then, it had been years since Nike had released its last signature shoe for women. No other brands had filled the void.
We talked about it often, like, man, what would a shoe look like? What would it feel like? Who would get a shoe? That's why we worked so hard. We was like, well, maybe we aren't working hard enough. We got to put, you know, good quality work on the floor to kind of convince them that, you know, we do deserve this.
Today, players like Simone or league MVP Breonna Stewart sometimes get custom models of men's signature shoes. But even with the widespread sneaker culture in the league, no WNBA player has a signature shoe to call her own. Last year, Simone found an opportunity for something different.
I was like, I want to make my shoes cool. I just don't want it to be the basic Kyrie. I wanted to have some kind of Simone in it.
In November, Simone posted a video on Instagram of her shoe collection from high school, and it got the attention of an independent shoe artist based nearby in Minneapolis. He messaged her with an offer. For a couple $100s, he would take a pair of her shoes and hand paint them using her design ideas.
I love watching cartoons. I'm a big kid at heart. And so I started to play around with the cartoons and things like that.
And since the WNBA has no color or design restrictions for its players' shoes, Simone took Scrooge McDuck, Penny Proud, and even the Care Bears onto the court with her.
So in a lot of ways, this project is kind of your own way of making your own signature shoe, right?
Yeah, I'm hoping that it will open up people's minds to be like, you know what? We should give her a shoe and let her kind of design something.
In August, just before the start of the WNBA playoffs, Nike re-released the Air Swoops 2. And even though Nike still doesn't make them in her size, Simone was first in line.
I said, forget it. I'm buying a pair. I got a size 12. I'm hoping that I can squeeze my foot in there. I think it left an amazing mark to see an amazing woman like Swoop, who's accomplished all that she's accomplished in the WNBA and in basketball, period, to be celebrated in that way.
Simone Augustus hopes that by supporting the Air Swoops and rocking custom kicks, she and other WNBA players can inspire the next generation of women's hoopers, and maybe even a shoe company or two.
It's so disappointing to me to walk in the store and I have no other choice but to buy a male sneaker. It's time to change the narrative. We put in the work, we've earned our moment to be able to prove to people that we can do this. It's time.
Only a Game's Matthew Stock brought us that story. And in case you're wondering, Nike says they brought back the Swoops 2 to connect new generations of women to the sport. It's a nice start, but wouldn't a new shoe be even better? We've all been there. You're watching sports on TV, and just when the phone rings, something amazing happens. Thanks to the wonders of the DVR, you can just rewind a few seconds and watch that great play over and over. And guess what? You can do the same thing with Only a Game. Subscribe to our podcast. You'll be able to rewind anytime so you don't miss a thing. And while you're subscribing, leave us a review. It will help other listeners find our show. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This message comes from Only a Game sponsor, Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager, full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. We're going to start this week by analyzing a new scientific study. I'm not joking, but I promise it'll be fun. I'm joined by Michael Lee of The Athletic and by Nora Princiati of the Boston Globe. Welcome back to you both.
Thanks to be here.
Thank you, Karen.
So I don't normally follow the latest research out of the Aspen Institute, but this week our friend Patrick Ruby tweeted out an interesting report. They studied the dangers and benefits of high school sports. And no surprise, football was ranked the very worst for causing injuries. But it was also ranked number two for what they called psychosocial benefits. And football would have been ranked number one for psychosocial benefits if not for the fact that football players are also more likely to engage in risky behaviors like excessive drinking. But that to me seems like a self-selecting kind of thing. Like kids who are going to be attracted to risky behaviors are also going to be attracted to the risky sport of football. So this really sums up to me the issue that we've been grappling with for about the past decade, which is there a way to make football less dangerous without turning off the kids that need it the most? And those are the kids who are attracted to the dangers of football. And I'm all questions and no answers. So, Nora, what do you think?
So, first of all, my perspective on football is that kids don't need to play it in high school. High school football scares me, frankly, just because all the research shows that when your brain is younger, that's when it's the most vulnerable. And the thing that I thought looking at the study was just that the psychosocial benefits seemed more related to playing a team sport than playing football specifically. So even as a football writer, I looked at it and thought, well, yeah, that's great, but don't you think it's maybe just being outside and being on a team and making friends?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I have an issue with high school football as much as I do like Pop Warner, like, yeah. Like really little kids. But I think that, you know, at a high school level, you know, that's kind of like those awkward years where you're trying to find yourself. The teams are usually pretty big. Mm-hmm. And so you're a part of a really large community and you have the whole town behind you. You know, I know from my years from covering high school football, I know just what that sport can do to just bring people together and to also raise that self-esteem of the athletes that perform, because you got 11 guys sort of on the field as one. If you play high school basketball, the gym may be empty. If you play cross country, for sure, you're really by yourself because there's no one there to cheer you, even when you cross the finish line. And I know that from running cross country in high school. But football, I can totally understand why it's viewed positively by the participants. That doesn't make it any less dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up youth football, and certainly the solution there has been to suggest that kids under 14 just play flag football instead, that they don't really need to tackle.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah, and I'm totally
so
in
Brett
favor
Favre
of that.
And,
yeah. And, you know, Tom Brady and the Mannings, none of them played tackle football until they were a little bit older. But what was interesting to me in this study, because I have thought, hey, what if we just made high school football, flag football? Like, would the community still show up? Would you still get those 100 kids who are all working towards the same thing? And this study really made me question my own sort of point of view on that, because then I wonder, these kids who are looking for a risky behavior, I'm not sure they're going to find it in flag football. So it's a problem. There's definitely more work to do. Michael, basketball. We need some basketball. Help us out here.
We have our latest effort to fix an issue for college basketball that avoids the obvious solution, paying the players. You see that the G League is now offering an alternative to the NCAA's one-and-done rule by providing the ultimate incentive to have elite prospects from high school, 18 years old, who aren't eligible for the draft, to come and play for $125,000 a year, which is a lot of money, especially when you consider that this is more than the max salary for a WNBA player. And that's another topic that we could discuss later. But the best part about these select contracts that the G League is going to offer is that the players are able to sell their likeness. They're able to sign with an agent. But there is a risk to this. One being, you're playing in the G League. So you're playing with grown men. So you may not be able to establish yourself or separate yourself from a skill perspective, as you would say in college when you're playing against guys your own age. Also, the G League does not provide the platform that a billion-dollar industry like the NCAA will. While I applaud the G League for trying to provide an alternative, I think that the NCAA could actually benefit their athletes, and especially the elite basketball players, by just allowing them to have the ability to hire an agent to sell their likeness and to sign shoe deals. I think that could resolve the issue of paying the players. I just wonder, can the NCAA ever just step up and just solve its own problem?
Well, so I would say that no, I have absolutely no confidence in the NCAA just sort of one day waking up and deciding like, oh, we're going to do the right thing here. Cool. That said, probably the best possible outcome from this, right, or at least as I see it, would be that the threat of elite high school players going to the G League instead of being one and dones would be enough to push the NCAA to reform. They're not going to do it on their own because they just feel like it. I mean, I think the only way it works, and this seems like an uphill battle, is if the G League alternative is a good enough one that it can actually be a source of real pressure on the NCAA, which would be the first time that there's an alternative that's been able to do that, right?
If guys were actually getting drafted out of the G League into those top spots, then I think it could work. But Michael, you promised that we could talk about the WNBA issue, so I'm going to hold you to that. WNBA players get paid less than these top high schoolers would. I didn't immediately make that connection, like, hey, this is really proof that something is a little off here. Exactly. And it really shows how ingrained this idea is that men, male athletes should always get paid more than female athletes. And no one is suggesting that WNBA players should get paid as much as NBA players.
No.
But I do, you know, Sue Bird has said that there's a bias that exists here. And I really think the idea of minor league players in a league that hasn't even, like, they're not even on
TV. They're not on ESPN.
Right?
On TV. Yeah.
And the fact that they would make
more.
The
Big Three has a better television deal than the G League.
Right. I mean, if we need a stronger indication that there is a bias, I don't think we'd find one.
Amen. I totally agree. I think it's really unfair. Diana Taurasi is my favorite basketball player, like male or female. Like, I love seeing her play. And then you have this deal that's sort of like a slap in the face to sort of remind you that, yeah, in this country, we reward male athletes much more significantly than we do females.
Well, the percentage of total revenue that goes to player salaries in the WNBA is significantly lower.
20 to 25%.
Right, exactly. And in the NBA, 50%. It's 50.
Instead of 50%.
So, as is only a game tradition, we save our most important topic for last. Nora, do you?
Yeah, I think this is going to mark the end of my tenure as a Boston Globe Patriots reporter, because I'm sure that I am just days from a call-up to the Spotlight investigative team. I wrote a piece recently about touchdown and big play celebrations, and it was kind of it's something that the NFL has been letting players do a little bit more. I love when guys get really creative about it. I went around and did a little digging in the Patriots locker room and pulled a bunch of guys to come up with kind of a grading system for how to look at a celebration and decide if it's up to snuff. And I have a confession for you guys, because what all the Patriots players said was that you just can't celebrate when you're losing. And this had actually happened. The Colts got an interception a couple weeks ago in a game, and they were down by 2 scores. And they start celebrating and, like, doing this dance. They're, you know, close to the end zone. The cameras got them. And obviously on TV, you see the score right below. And you're like, ooh, guys, rough. And I'm going around and they're all saying, well, you can't celebrate when you're losing. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, and this is why I'm not a professional athlete, but can't you?
Well, it depends on how much you're losing by.
Right. But I just believe in everybody's right to hype themselves.
I support that as well. And, like, if you pick off Tom Brady, you should, you know, let everybody know. Yeah, I picked off Tom Brady. Watch me stomp. Yeah. But if you're getting your butt kicked, you just look kind of silly.
I love all of these. You know, it's so funny. The NFL and football traditionalists stood in the way of this for so long. And they were like, football is a team sport. It's not about the individual. And, like, celebration is unseemly. And meanwhile, we get these celebrations that are, like, joyous and fun, and they include teamwork, and they are so much more interesting than what was allowed before, which was basically like a grunt in the end zone that made these guys look like Neanderthals. I mean, like, you see, like, creativity and all these wonderful things.
It's cool, but I like the rogue element of it being forbidden. Like, I like it when Terrell Owens, you know, grabbed the pom-poms.
Hiding the Sharpie in
and
the,
like,
sock.
Yeah, the Sharpie in the sock. Like, that's legendary. Like, for me, now that everybody is sort of, you know, encouraged to celebrate, it's gotten a little corny. I'm like, you spent a whole week thinking of this one? You know? So I judge them much more harshly now that they're kind of given the permission to do it.
By my own admission, I'm a very corny person, so I'm...
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Athletic's Michael Lee and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Absolutely, Karen.
Growing up, Colleen Tye's family was obsessed with sports, baseball mostly. But Colleen wasn't interested. She wanted to be an artist and a writer, and now she is. A little while back, Colleen became obsessed with the sport of powerlifting, but she struggled to explain to people outside of the sport why she loved it so much. So she turned her experience into a comic. I asked Colleen to read from her comic and tell me her story in her own words.
Like a lot of women, I found out my body didn't belong to me fairly early.
Can you tell me about the first time you remember feeling that way?
When I was very young, I was more of a tomboy. I just absolutely hated having to like curl my hair and like put a bow in it and wear a dress. And I think that was the first time that I sort of understood that like how I was presenting myself wasn't my choice. That turned into like self-loathing of my body based on what I thought I was supposed to look like. I remember I would watch TV shows and like desperately look to see if there was any woman that like wasn't skinny who was happy in the show.
When you were a teenager and you looked in the mirror, what did you see?
Oh, I was like, I'm a disgusting beast. I just hated ever looking in the mirror and being reminded of how I looked. And then when I got into college, I basically discovered exercise as a way to lose weight and dieting as a way to lose weight. I copied the people I saw around me. I starved, I binged, I did what should be an illegal amount of burpees. The idea of exercise as an adult was always this thing that I did to punish my body into looking a way that I wanted it to look. I started getting very, very obsessive with going to the gym. I was going 6 days a week, eating a very, very small amount of calories. It felt good in that it felt like I was in control of this thing, but of course I wasn't. There's never a period of time when you're in that kind of mindset that you will ever be happy, no matter what you look like.
Before a year ago, I had no idea what powerlifting was. I'd never been to a weight room. They are historically not designed for me.
Weight rooms were this weird place that I just didn't even recognize as a place that I could go. Like, I had absolutely zero clue what you were supposed to do in a weight room. I think it's intimidating for anyone who doesn't know what they're doing, but it's especially intimidating if you're a woman because you feel like, why are you here taking up space where all these like big burly men could be using the space that you're in?
Modern gyms are rooted in all-male institutions, from the Greek gymnasium to bodybuilding gyms of the 20th century.
So how did you break through that? How did you first start lifting weights?
So I first started lifting weights because I was doing a program. It had Bikini Body in the name. Like, it's very, like, not great. But part of that program is they introduced the idea of using these very light barbell squats. And I realized, like, I enjoyed doing those, and I thought they were kind of fun. Basically, someone had been like, well, if you lift weights, like, 3 times a week, you can get the same body for, like, half the amount of time. I was like, that sounds great. Of course I'm going to try to do that.
The first time I put a barbell on my back, I almost fell over. I felt stupid, I felt weak, and I felt very female. I finished the rest of my sets, and I went home, embarrassed.
It was at a gym near my house, and they only have one squat rack. So you walk up there, you put the bar in your back, and you go to squat, and it's so weird, and it so requires so much balance, and you're wobbling all over the place, and you just feel very stupid, and like someone is waiting to use the squat rack, and they can clearly see you have no idea what you're doing. I'm pretty short at that time. I was very skinny, and I definitely was freaked out for a while, for the first couple of months while I was doing it. And I was like, I'm going to prove them all wrong. I'm going to get really strong.
Powerlifting is a brute sport. It does not care what you look like. It is simple. Have you done more than the last time? What turned my timid shuffles to the squat rack into a serious obsession was following female powerlifters online. They were not like other Fitspo women I had seen.
Fitness inspiration. So it's Fitspo. Fitspo definitely encompasses, it's more of like a lifestyle brand where it's like, look at how like skinny and beautiful I am. If you do my 15-minute workout, you will also be skinny and beautiful.
Hello, my strong, strong friends. Today, I gotta be completely honest with you.
The first pretty famous powerlifter I ever started following is this woman. Her name on Instagram and YouTube is called Meg Squats. It stopped being like, I'm going to follow Meg Squats because I want to look exactly like her. And instead became, oh, I want to follow Meg Squats because I also want to deadlift 400 pounds at some point.
I'm never worried about how I look. I'm always worried about how much I'm lifting.
She would talk about being scared that you're going to be bulky or like too big or manly or whatever.
And were you afraid of that at first?
Oh, yeah. I was like, oh, I'm going to stop squatting at a certain weight so I don't get too big. Now that I've gotten into it, I'm like, why are my arms so small? I want my arms to be huge. Like, I have to eat like 20 eggs or something. Women are flocking to powerlifting. From 2014 to 2017, the number of women competing in powerlifting has more than doubled, and they now make up 1/3 of the sport. It's no surprise once you start doing it. Lifting feels purposeful, to do something that's not tied to blasting fat or toning my core. I'm getting bigger. I have to eat to grow muscles and recover. I am watching things grow in my body that I've never thought I wanted there before. All that matters now is showing up to move something very heavy and very big. Suddenly there's this whole new way of looking at food where instead of it being like this enemy, it was like, no, like you need fat to synthesize protein in order to build muscle in your body. And that totally transformed how I feel like I dealt with food. Instead of it being this, I'm going to go on an hour-long run, it'll burn 600 calories, and now I can like eat pizza. It's no, like I'm going to eat pizza so I can lift a bunch of weight tomorrow.
What do you see when you look in the mirror these days?
I used to like, you know, stand in front of the mirror and obsess about everything. And there's obviously good days and bad days, but I can look at myself and be not even like, oh, I think I look great every day, but at least just look at myself and be like, cool, there I am. That's what I look like.
That's Colleen Tai in her own words. Her comic is called Powerlifting Doesn't Care What I Look Like. It was published by The Nib and we'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Craig Breedlove designed, built, and drove jet-powered cars that shattered land speed records.
He was a little guy in his dad's garage, and he did something absolutely huge.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, from Colin Kaepernick to an Austrian soccer player who may or may not have stood up to the Nazis, we'll look at athletes who stand or sit or kneel in protest. But now it's time for this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
It's not normal for us to start this segment by talking about USA Gymnastics, but these are not normal times. We're going to take this week's developments one by one, starting with the arrest on Wednesday of Steve Penny, the organization's former president. Did you ever think you'd see something like this?
Well, first of all, unfortunately, it's becoming all too common that we start this segment with talking about USA Gymnastics.
It's true.
And for all the wrong reasons. This guy's unbelievable. This Steve Penny guy, he took it on the lam. This guy ran a sports organization.
Right.
And he's on the lam. And they have to track him down in Gatlinburg, where they have to bring him back to Huntsville, Texas.
A grand jury in Texas has indicted Penny for allegedly destroying or hiding documents relating to Dr. Larry Nassar, who has been sentenced to more than 100 years in prison for sexually abusing athletes. And I really, really want to see what's in those missing documents,
yeah,
don't you?
As does everyone else, including, I suspect, some of Nassar's victims. I think one way or another, either at this guy's trial or in the discovery, in the 8 zillion lawsuits that are going to be filed against USA Gymnastics, we're going to see what's in the documents, and it's not going to be great.
So let's talk about Mary Bono. She was announced.
Which I never thought I would do again, by the way.
Right, right. Well, she was announced last Friday as USA Gymnastics' new interim president. By Tuesday, she had resigned. There were two major issues. First up, does the fact that Ms. Bono worked for a law firm that also represented Larry Nassar disqualify her from running USA Gymnastics?
Yes. Next question.
All right. Next question. The second issue to me is a bit more complicated. In September, a month before she got the job, Mary Bono tweeted an image, and in it, she was using a marker to black out the swoosh on her golf shoes. And as anti-Colin Kaepernick tweets go, this one was pretty tame. I might disagree with her point of view, but I respect her right to express it. You?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I missed the memo in which Mary Bono somehow became qualified to run USA Gymnastics.
True, true.
Second of all, she managed to alienate both Nike and Simone Biles. When you've alienated the primary corporate sugar daddy and the face of your sport, it's really time to go, and it's pretty convincing evidence that you shouldn't have been there in the first place.
I mean, what can USA Gymnastics do at this point to at all bring anybody back?
The Olympics will bring people back. You will see what will probably be a Nike-fueled run-up to the next Olympics, where whoever represents the United States, and God knows Simone Biles is going to be one of them, are going to be the redemption team. They're going to be the ones who bring honesty and non-criminal behavior back to women's gymnastics. And it will sell because the Olympics will help it sell.
Charlie, you and I have been saying for a while that the best thing that the NFL could do regarding players who choose to kneel is absolutely nothing. And they seem to have listened to us. Are you surprised?
No, because we're smart, Karen, and more people should listen to us. No, I mean, the basic problem the NFL had with the whole anthem thing was they had three or four owners who were off the reservation on it. Jerry Jones, Bob McNair down in Houston, Jerry Richardson in Carolina. Those guys have been pretty much marginalized if they didn't depart the league entirely, like Jerry Richardson. And once cooler heads prevailed, they realized that probably 40% of their fans are at the beer stand during the anthem anyway. And the ones that, you know, are offended by this, they can afford to offend.
What I really love about this story is that they actually came up with actual data that showed that tweets made by the president didn't turn
right.
fans off to the football. What turned fans off to football was those owners speaking up.
Right.
And finally, Charlie, I want to draw your attention to the Kenya Ice Lions, because the country only has enough ice hockey players to field one team. They had never played a game against an opponent. So why has this team made international news?
First of all, I want a jersey.
Oh,
I want a jersey
nice.
So bad. Apparently, Sidney Crosby and Nathan MacKinnon helped these guys come to Toronto to play against a team of firefighters. And then Crosby and MacKinnon played for the Kenyans. The last story on our segment every week is usually a funny one.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a funny one. This is an aww.
Aww.
And MacKinnon even said, hey, these guys skate really fast, which is pretty good considering most of them didn't skate before last year.
There's a video because, of course, it's sponsored by a coffee company. And my favorite bit is one of the Kenyan players reaches out and, like, pats Sidney Crosby on the face and says, is it really you?
I've always maintained you can sell hockey anywhere if you give it a chance. You could sell hockey in Kenya. I hope the Ice Lions practice very hard and are in the next Olympics, because they will be the biggest thing there.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
In the fall of 1963, the Beach Boys celebrated a national hero. Just 2 months earlier, Craig Breedlove and the jet engine-powered Spirit of America had set a new land speed record. But Breedlove didn't stop there. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
On October 15th, 1964, Craig Breedlove hurtled across Utah's Bonneville Salt Flats. He reached a top speed of 526 miles per hour.
He's coming. He's moving right along. He's really pouring it on. Here he comes.
Breedlove had just surpassed his own land speed record. But things began to go wrong as he tried to slow down. The first problem was with the emergency parachute.
The chute broke off, and I didn't know that that had happened.
But he did know about some of the other things that were going wrong. The steering was malfunctioning, and then there were the brakes.
He tries the brakes. They melt.
That's writer Samuel Hawley.
He has no brakes. He's going 500 miles an hour. He's running out of course, and he's got no way to stop.
So I came down the course and went through the place that I'm supposed to be stopped.
Went through is understatement in the extreme.
I was still traveling a good 400 miles an hour.
Crew members gave chase in cars, but their top speeds were just 70 or 80 miles per hour. They knew Spirit of America wouldn't stop before it reached a construction site at the edge of the highway.
I had to make it over a wooden bridge that they had built and ended up knocking down a telephone pole by Highway 80 and went over an embankment at about 220 miles an hour, and the car went airborne.
Breedlove wouldn't tell me if he was terrified when that happened. He's too logical and too analytical to betray emotion. But put yourself in the cockpit of Spirit of America as it launched skyward. Wouldn't you be? And wouldn't that make you rethink your career choice? Craig Breedlove grew up in Mar Vista, California, a residential neighborhood in West Los Angeles. At first, he wasn't interested in cars. He liked to build model airplanes.
And he wasn't just making kits. He was actually designing and making planes from scratch.
Until he noticed what his neighbors were up to.
And he went across the street and he said, "Hey guys, what are you doing?" And they said, "I'm making a hot rod." That was it. He started building his first car when he was 13.
Breedlove graduated from high school in 1955. By the time he was 20, he was married with three kids. But he had big dreams.
I wanted not to live my whole life and die and just be a marker on a tombstone. I just had a real drive to do something that was significant.
Breedlove took odd jobs to support his young family. He found some time to build hot rods, which gave him an idea. The land speed record of 394 miles per hour had been set by a British racer in 1947. Breedlove would try to break it with the help of new technology.
It was right at the end of the Korean War era.
There was a particular fighter jet engine that Craig had his eye on, the General Electric J-47.
There were literally thousands of those engines that came onto the surplus market.
And he went down to the place in L.A. where they had several hundred of these jet engines, and he asked the guy, "You know, how much do you get for scrap for one of these things?" And the guy said, "About $500. So Craig says, "Well, if I gave you $500, could I have one?" And the guy said, "Yeah, I'll set one aside for you."
Breedlove lined up sponsors and designed an aluminum and fiberglass vehicle that looked more like a missile than a car. In 1960, he began working on it in his father's garage. He called it Spirit of America. Over the next few years, competition for the land speed record grew fierce, and lots of people watched. This was an era of national optimism, fueled by the space race and rapid technological progress. Craig Breedlove's 1963 triumph had made him a star. But now other drivers and designers wanted the spotlight and the land speed record. Foremost among them was Ohio farmer Art Arfons, who drove a fast and dangerous machine called Green Monster.
He had a crash just about every time. His right rear tire would blow, and somehow he kept his big car from rolling and killing him, but it was scary.
Arfons and Breedlove returned to Bonneville for the 1964 season.
And at this point, Craig is becoming afraid. He's becoming frightened. The stress, the strain is all getting so intense. So when he heads back again with the goal to go 500 miles an hour, he really has a premonition that he's going to get killed.
On October 2nd, a car designed by Art Arfon's brother reached 413 miles per hour. 3 days later, Art himself topped out at 434. 8 days after that, Breedlove pushed the record to 468. But he knew Spirit of America, with a new jet engine that featured an afterburner, could go even faster. which brings us back to Breedlove's 526-mile-per-hour record-setting run on October 15th of 1964, when he rocketed past his astonished crew. With no brakes or emergency parachute and very little steering, Breedlove cut the engine. But he was still going more than 200 miles an hour by the time he hit that embankment and launched into the air over an evaporation pond.
The first time I hit the water, the car kind of skipped like a rock that you throw across a lake, and it jumped off the water. And the second time it came down, the water grabbed it really tight and sucked me down. And then I was starting to sink. I had my seatbelt off and everything, but I couldn't get out of the cockpit, and it was starting to take me under the water. And then I realized I hadn't unplugged my breathing mask.
Breedlove freed himself and swam to shore. He was met by his crew.
I'm not doing it again.
What a ride.
Well, for my next trick.
Spirit of America was recovered, repaired, and donated to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. In the fall of 1965, Breedlove, in a new car, and Art Arfons met once more at Bonneville.
And Art said, so what's going to happen here, Craig? If I take the record from you, are you just going to come back and take it back from me? And we're going to keep going back and forth until one of us gets killed? And Craig was kind of taken aback by this, but he said, well, yeah, I guess so. And so Art Arfons says, well, it's going to be like a game of Russian roulette then.
Breedlove went first. On November 2nd, he reached 555 miles per hour. 3 days later, Arfons took the record back.
It was 576 miles an hour that Art pushed it to.
On November 15th, Breedlove took two runs. On the second,
the nose of his Spirit of America Sonic One is starting to lift off the ground. He's on the verge of flying, but somehow he hung on and he set the record at 600.601 miles per hour. Amazingly, no one died.
Craig Breedlove's land speed record fell in 1970. Soon after, he was selling real estate. Breedlove tried to take the record back in 1996, but he failed in that attempt. He's happy with his accomplishments, but once a barrier pusher, always a barrier pusher.
We're working on a car to break 1,000 miles an hour, but so far we haven't been able to raise the necessary backing. I won't be driving it anyway. So anyway, I'm 81 now, so enough's enough.
Samuel Hawley knows not as many people care about the land speed record as in the 60s. But, he says, Craig Breedlove's example is timeless.
Craig had the naivety to believe that somebody so little and insignificant as him could actually achieve something so big. He was a little guy in his dad's garage, and he did something absolutely huge.
That story was by Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Samuel Hawley's new book is Ultimate Speed, The Fast Life and Extreme Cars of Racing Legend Craig Breedlove. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. Our final word comes from former land speed record holder Craig Breedlove.
I probably got more famous from the Beach Boys than I did for setting records.
I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.